The team at the Investigators and Burning Mountain Productions would like to remind you that persons associated with crimes or potential wrongdoing discussed on this episode are presumed innocent until proven otherwise in a court of law or administrative action.
Oh, I've been running from the law. Hope they won't shoot me down soon.
I'm Todd McComas.
And I'm Jessica Knoll. And we are
the Investigators.
Try to catch me howling at the moon.
Welcome back to all our partners in crime. We hope you had a crime-free week. And if you did not, we hope that everyone is okay and that you have the right investigators on the case.
And if you don't, reach out to us. That's what we're here for.
Just so everybody knows, we record these episodes way in advance. So we never know exactly when they're going to come out. We have been to CrimeCon, and we've been back from CrimeCon for a little bit. But I feel like I want to let everybody know that we had an amazing time.
I put this on social, but I feel like this was my fourth CrimeCon, and I think, hands down, this was the best that I've been to.
Absolutely. So I just want everybody to know, if we met you there, we enjoyed so much meeting you. For those of you that we already knew and we got to see again, we loved seeing you again. And for those new people that we met, I just want to point this out. We passed out 1,500 swag bags, bags full of free swag that had our logo and whatnot on it. And I don't think we've gotten all 1,500 of you as regular listeners yet. So if you took a swag bag and you're listening now and you know somebody else that took a swag bag and they're not listening, catch them up.
That was the deal. We made that deal with every single person we handed it to. And in fact, it has an investigator's notebook in it.
Right. How are you not a regular listener when you have a free investigator's notebook?
Come on.
Catch up, I'm saying. All right, enough about CrimeCon. We had an awesome time. Obviously, CrimeCon is an amazing event for people like us and people like you who enjoy listening to people like us. So thank goodness for the people at CrimeCon.
And for the families that we cover in these. There were so many families. So thank you everyone for coming.
I enjoyed so much meeting Gabby Petito's family, by the way. Mm-hmm. They are salt of the earth. They're doing such amazing things for other families now. Kudos to them. Look up their foundation, the Gabby Petito Foundation, and give, because they're doing great things.
Yes.
Everyone grab a shovel, because we're getting ready to dig into this week's case. This week, we're headed to the bourbon capital of the world, a place once deemed the most beautiful small town in America. And with good reason. Its quaint southern charm and beauty is unrivaled. A place where city folk can get away and escape the fast-paced hustle of home. But beneath its picturesque streets and surrounds, this town bears some horrible secrets. Secrets that are now coming to light as the first of several unsolved cases yields prosecution. This case takes place in Bardstown, Kentucky.
I've been covering the missing persons, suspicious death, and unsolved murders in this small town since 2013. But this one begins 2 years later, on 4th of July weekend in 2015. A 35-year-old mother of five vanishes. She's last seen by her boyfriend and the father of her youngest child following an evening of feeding cows at his family's farm. But it's her mother who reports her missing.
The search begins soon after. Her car is found abandoned with a flat tire on the side of the Bluegrass Parkway. Inside, they find her keys, purse, and cell phone, but no sign of the missing mother.
This is Crystal Rogers' story. Crystal's family has been advised not to speak to the media right now about her case. And because we want to respect that and not jeopardize anything pertaining to prosecution in this case, I'm going to tell you a little bit about Crystal myself. I sat down with her family, including her mom, Sherry Ballard, back in 2019. When I arrived at Sherry's home, Crystal's son met me outside. And that's when a tiny butterfly fluttered over to me and gently landed on my finger. And it lingered. I smiled, and Crystal's son looked at me and said, "They believe butterflies are someone special." Their someone special loved butterflies, and her family believes Crystal sends these little winged beauties to show them she's still with them. Sherry greets us with a hug as we walk inside. I'm also greeted by the many photos and trinkets remembering Crystal. Angels, butterflies, and her missing persons flyer posted prominently on the refrigerator. Crystal is beautiful, blonde, blue eyes, and has a smile that beams off Sherry's mantle in family photos. She's the oldest of the Ballard children, born in 1980. Sherry vividly remembers Crystal as a good kid growing up, and very shy in school. She was easy to get along with and had no enemies.
Okay, you've been read into Crystal's case and you've heard from Jessica about who Crystal was to those who loved her. Now it's time to join us in the war room so we can take a deeper dive into what we know about her case.
As soon as Crystal was reported missing, the Nelson County Sheriff's Office began investigating along with the Kentucky State Police. Then, 5 years later, the FBI took over as lead.
And as a result of their involvement, there's been a huge break in her case. So we're going to start there and double back in the timeline of her disappearance and the investigation.
A lot happened in Crystal's case over the summer of 2023. In June, the charge of tampering with physical evidence was filed. And on July 24th, another charge was filed: conspiracy to commit murder in connection to Crystal's disappearance. An arrest warrant was issued for a man, but his identity and the information pertaining to the warrants were sealed. However, in August, the man's name was revealed as police arrested 32-year-old Joseph Lawson of Nelson County, Kentucky. Remember this last name? Write it down in your notebook. He was indicted on both charges, and on September 7th, Joseph Lawson was arraigned and pleaded not guilty to both charges.
He's accused of mutilating, destroying, concealing, removing, or altering physical evidence, as well as agreeing to aid one or more persons in the planning of a crime or a commission of a crime that intentionally caused the death of another.
Okay, Todd, let's talk about conspiracy charges. It would seem as though this is just the beginning as it pertains to arrests in her case, because a conspiracy, by its very nature, is an agreement between two or more people to commit a crime.
Yeah, you can't indict someone for conspiracy to commit murder without having clearly laid out the details of the conspiracy and who the other conspirator or conspirators are. And you're going to have to put all that information in your probable cause affidavit and or application for indictment, or you're going to have to provide all that information to a grand jury via testimony. So even though this entire conspiracy detailing who did what is not available to the public yet, it's all mapped out somewhere, and a judge and or grand jury has reviewed it and made the determination that the government has presented enough evidence to establish probable cause that everyone indicted in this conspiracy did enter into an agreement to murder Crystal Rogers.
We're going to talk a lot about a man named Brooks Houck in this episode. Brooks was Crystal's boyfriend and her son's father. So let's go back to when Crystal and Brooks met, according to her mom. The young mother and the owner of Houck Rentals met in 2010. Crystal rented a property from Brooks, and after she became pregnant with their child, she moved in with Brooks at his home. And their baby boy was born in 2012. Sherry said Crystal was looking for stability for her children and thought, he's polite, clean cut, owns his own business, good on paper. Crystal believed this relationship would provide a better life for herself and for her children. But according to Sherry, there were arguments between the couple, and they started to escalate. She remembers on their first Christmas together, right after Crystal had given birth to their son, they came to the family Christmas party. Her mom remembers Crystal and the baby arrived alone. She was in tears and said she and Brooks had had an argument and he refused to come with them. Not a great introduction to her daughter's new family. But on the last weekend Crystal was ever seen, Sherry said she received a call from her teenage granddaughter, Crystal's daughter, Kylie. It's 4th of July, 2015, and she hasn't seen her mom. Neither had Sherry, but she didn't think much of it since it was a holiday. Sherry sends Crystal a text message at 6:42 p.m. Kylie is trying to get in touch with you. Nothing. Sherry starts texting the family and making calls. No one has heard from Crystal. She calls Crystal numerous times. No answer. She texts her again at 9:27 p.m. Everyone is worried about you, even your kids. Call someone. This was really strange. Crystal always returned Sherry's calls and texts, and she hopes it's as simple as Crystal's phone has died. But when Sunday, July 5th comes, and she still hasn't heard from her daughter, worry is starting to settle in. She knows something isn't right.
Sherry sees Brooks at the gas station. She inquires about Crystal, and Brooks tells her that he hasn't seen her, but the two of them had argued. Sherry was already alarmed, but the moment she saw their baby in his car seat, her heart sank. She knew her daughter would never leave her children and not tell anyone where and why she had left. That was the moment Sherry knew something was terribly wrong.
She reports Crystal missing to the Nelson County Sheriff's Office that day. Not long after, Crystal's father, Tommy Ballard, gets a call from his son-in-law. Crystal's car, a maroon Chevy sedan, is found on the side of the Bluegrass Parkway at mile marker 14. Her car has a flat tire, and when police search the interior, they find her keys, her purse, and her cell phone. Police search down the hill from the highway, but no sign of Crystal. Crystal's family goes back with a search party, armed with flashlights in hand, and they look for Crystal without police and without Brooks until the wee hours of the morning. Again, no Crystal. It didn't take long for Crystal's family to form a group dubbed Team Crystal to manage the search efforts for her. And according to her family, over the course of the entire investigation, which spans the past 8 years, Brooks Houck has never participated in any of their searches for Crystal.
I don't think I have to say this out loud, but I will anyway. That's a huge red flag. We never speak in absolutes on this show, but when the spouse or significant other doesn't take part in the search efforts for their missing spouse or significant other, it usually means there's something wrong. There's something we, as investigators, don't know about the dynamic of the relationship between the missing and their significant other. Now, it doesn't always mean they are responsible for their significant other's disappearance, but if I had to lay money on the reason why, that's the bet I'm taking. But it could also mean other things, like there's friction between the missing person's family and the significant other, or the significant other is the main suspect and his attorney has advised him not to participate. There are obviously other explanations, but we're all human beings with the capacity to love. So when we see another human being choose to not actively participate in the search efforts for their missing loved one, our noses start to twitch because something stinks.
Well, here's what Brooks says happened that weekend. Brooks and Crystal were at his mom's farm feeding the cows on Friday, July 3rd. He said he lit a small brush fire after they fed the cows, and they took a walk together with their toddler son. They headed home around midnight.
So you guys get back and load up in the truck. Load up in the truck and you drive back. You leave out. I see you leave out the driveway at about 11:55. Somebody passes you on the drive back on Loretta Road about 10 minutes after midnight or so. He says roughly. We're still kind of narrowing that down, but roughly sees you about 10 after midnight, which wouldn't be uncommon. It's been raining most of the day. You know, the way the roads are kind of wet. 15 minutes from your mom's house to the golf course. There's Caddyshack. Mm-hmm. Not a big deal there. And so do you remember, or did you go straight home on Friday night, or did y'all stop somewhere? Or because I'm thinking if that's their normal 7-8 o'clock in the evening, it might be dinner time. Did you stop and eat something, or did you go straight home?
We did not eat anything. I went straight home.
Okay. So you went straight home. So if we assume that he's correct in about 10 minutes after midnight, another 10 minutes to the house or so. So you
get I don't see it being that late. I mean, if that's what some of the things say, you know, I guess you'd have to kind of go by that. But yeah, we didn't stop anywhere. We went straight home.
Okay. When they got home at about 12:20 a.m., he said he went to bed and Crystal stayed up playing games on her phone in the living room and their son was running around playing. When he woke up the next morning, their son was in bed next to him, but Crystal was gone.
Okay, so let's look at the scenario Brooks has presented here. From his own account, pretty awesome day and night for the family. Then when he wakes up, Crystal is gone. He has no idea why. She didn't say she was leaving, and she didn't leave a note. He says she's just gone. Now, as a detective, you know that's not how people disappear. That's how they disappear in sci-fi movies. But we're going to operate from the assumption that extraterrestrials did not beam Crystal up from her house to the mothership. So that means there's an earthly reason she wasn't there in the morning, and we need to start looking for that reason within her timeline.
When Brooks wakes up the next morning between 6 and 7 a.m., he says his 2-year-old son is in the bed next to him. But Crystal isn't there, so he gets dressed while his son stays asleep. He said he called Crystal because she was nowhere to be found inside their house, but he wasn't that concerned because he said she's done this before, going out with her sister or her cousin and staying out all night.
Okay, so here we go. Brooks provides investigators with a hypothetical based on something he claims Crystal has done in the past. That being going out with her sister or cousin, presumably without telling him she was going to do that, and staying out all night. Well, hopefully by this time, we'd already have data from her phone, or at least we're waiting for its arrival so we can examine it. But either way, this is where investigators begin reaching out to her sister and cousin and everyone else who's close to her to see if Crystal had communicated to anyone a plan to secretly leave her home that night.
So back to Brooks, according to him, he takes his son to the farm with him that morning. This is Saturday, July 4th. That night, Brooks and his son attend a family barbecue at his uncle's house. He claims no one has asked where Crystal is, and they leave the family gathering before fireworks begin. Okay, so we're going to listen and analyze a very important video where Brooks' full story is revealed. This is the recorded interview inside the Nelson County Sheriff's Office on July 8th, 2015, 3 days after Crystal is reported missing by Sherry. Detective John Snow is interviewing her boyfriend, the father of her youngest son, and the last person to have seen her, Brooks Houck. Let's dig in.
I just called, trying to get a hold of him before he came here. I'm not answering his phone yet, so he must still be in the middle of it.
Oh, that's all right.
All right. I'm going to take a minute here and read through your statement. That's all right.
Yes.
Get an idea. You might have answered some of my questions already. So.
But I did, I was trying to cover as much as I could. If my writing's not real legible, you just ask me, I can clarify it real quick for you.
Okay. 4 o'clock, Bluegrass Center.
But I don't know these. I put approximately on these before.
I don't expect you to know exactly.
There's no way for me to.
My first question is, why did this detective choose to have Brooks provide a written statement before his oral interview? I would never do that. Now, there is a defendable reason for choosing to do that, because there are experts that are absolutely great at identifying deception through handwritten statements, experts that are great at highlighting parts within the written statement where they believe the author is being deceptive through word choice, noticeable differences in handwriting itself in those parts, things like this. Then once the detective receives that expert's analysis of the written statement, they are now armed with what parts of the written statement to attack in their interview or interrogation. But all that takes time. In this case, the detective is just quickly browsing through the written statement himself and then moving right into the oral interview. Now, the danger of that, in my opinion, is you just gave your primary suspect the opportunity to have a full dress rehearsal of his story right before you interview him. And if Brooks is going to lie, you gave him time to methodically create those lies. So instead of capturing his organic reaction in response to questions in which he plans to lie, you're letting him practice them for a bit. And most people remember things better after they have written them out. So I don't recommend that detectives do this.
Okay, so you're saying you should never get a written statement prior to the oral interview.
Well, again, I hate to speak in absolutes, so I'm not going to say this detective was wrong for choosing to do this. I'm just saying I wouldn't do it and letting you know why. I don't know this detective. Maybe he has extensive training in analyzing handwritten statements and he only needs a couple of minutes to adequately do so. But even if he is, Brooks talks to him constantly while he's reading through it, so I would challenge how much he's actually able to focus on what he's reading. So my money is always on creating organic and in-the-moment reactions and responses to difficult and important questions. If anything, I might choose to kill two birds with one stone and have him write out a full statement after my oral interview is complete. That way, we can compare the two and see if any details within his accounts change after his oral interview, and I can seek out an expert to analyze his written statement later to see if they notice any areas of concern that I didn't notice during my interview. Just flip that process. That's my personal opinion. Also, we should point out that it takes the detective roughly 10 minutes to read through the written statement, then he leaves the room for 2 minutes with the handwritten statement in hand. He then returns with a photocopy of his handwritten statement and gives Brooks the photocopy for his own records, and the detective keeps the original. Now, I'm not sure why he gave Brooks that copy. Maybe that was an agreement they made beforehand. I don't know. But there's nothing in the law that says I have to give the suspect a copy of his statement. That's for his lawyer to try to obtain later if things get to that point. I'm not trying to aid in my suspect's defense, so I'm not handing them a copy of his damn handwritten statement, but that's me.
Let's take a look at this part of the interview where a particular name comes up.
It was a pretty short phone conversation is the only reason I asked. Mm-hmm. Kind of unusual to get a 13-second phone conversation at midnight. You know, it is for me. It may not be for you. But,
all right. Well, just, well, that, just we'll check it out. Yeah, we'll check it out in detail. That's right.
So, Saturday morning, you wake up sometime between 6 and 7. I think we decided that Danny Singleton, is that his name?
Mm-hmm.
A guy that works for you, was calling you and called you pretty frequently. You said you sometimes you give him incentive to work on Saturdays.
Yeah.
And that may have been why he was calling you. So did you go do some work Saturday morning before you went to your mom's house? Before you went to the farm? Or what did you do Saturday morning?
No, I didn't. I didn't do any other work on Saturday morning. That's where I went out there to the farm.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know exactly what time I got out there, but that's what I had done.
Mm-hmm.
Now, for those of you who are only listening to this, Brooks's posture changes when the name Danny Singleton gets brought up. At 49 minutes and 37 seconds, he shifts in his chair and firmly crosses his arms in front of him and firmly readjusts the crossing of his left leg over his right. Now, again, there's no absolutes, but the crossing of the arms and crossing of the legs are both defensive postures. And many times when a suspect is challenged by a question that evokes emotion tied to a specific event they'd rather the interviewer not know about, we'll see this reaction because subconsciously it provides security for the person being interviewed. The crossed arms and legs can feel like an actual shield or barrier, if you will, that the suspect places between himself and the interviewer. And this is the only time during this entire two-hour interview that Brooks does this. Now, again, there can be other explanations for this reaction, so this doesn't conclusively mean the interviewer has entered a spot in the timeline or introduced a name that takes the suspect's memory to a guilty act. But if you're the interviewer, you gotta note that when I mentioned Danny Singleton, Brooks went from an open posture immediately to a closed or defensive posture, and you operate from the notion you have entered a sensitive point in that timeline.
So once you see his arms and legs crossed, closing off from you, the interviewer, what would you do from here?
Step one, opening back up. You create a mirror for him to emulate. Lean forward a bit, present an open posture yourself, because many times a person will mimic your posture. That's why this whole technique is called mirroring. And the reason you do that is you need them to open their posture because psychologically they feel less confident or protected without these barriers between them and you. So the bottom line is Brooks is not as confident with his response here as he has been up to this point. He seems a bit on his heels and he's embracing these closed or defensive postures. And the detective has not tried anything yet to open Brooks' posture up. So let's take a look and see if he tries to change that.
But first, you'll want to jot down Danny Singleton in your notebooks. That's because the most recent arrest is not the first arrest in connection to Crystal Rogers' disappearance. The first actually happened in December 2015, a few months following this police interview with Brooks. Danny Singleton was arrested for perjury in connection to her disappearance after testifying to a grand jury. He lied about where he was on July 3rd and 4th, 2015, the weekend she went missing. He testified that he was in Louisville and went to a bar with someone else. However, a witness refuted what he said and indicated he was at home in Bardstown on this date. Subsequently, he was indicted on 38 counts of perjury. Those were eventually changed to the lesser charge of false swearing. He was sentenced to 365 days and was released 8 months later in July 2016 and given 2 years probation. He was also a longtime friend, full-time employee, and tenant of Brooks Houck. And around this same time, there were two other men who, according to court documents I obtained, claimed that they had knowledge in Crystal's case. Vincent Nethery and Donald Howard, both of which implicated Danny Singleton in Crystal's murder. Later, they both recanted, admitting they lied in an effort to get out of jail, and they were both charged in January of 2016 with falsely reporting an incident. Just a side note, Vincent died in September 2019. He was 26 years old.
That's some juicy-ass information, by the way. Knowing what we just saw and heard from Brooks with that adverse reaction to hearing Danny Singleton's name.
Right. Okay. Let's get back to that interview with Brooks.
So you get up between 6 and 7, and where's Eli at when you wake up?
He's next to me.
He's in the bed with you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So you get up. Does he get up with you?
He's still asleep. So whenever I get up, but I go to the bathroom and all that kind of stuff, and he's still sleeping there on the bed.
Okay, the detective hasn't made any intentional adjustments on his end, but we do see and hear Brooks relax a bit as the detective diverts his questioning away from Danny Singleton. Now, I have no idea why he chooses to divert his questioning from Danny Singleton, but when he does, Brooks uncrosses his arms. He doesn't uncross his legs, but he's had them loosely crossed most of the interview, and I would note, so has the detective. So it's possible Brooks has been mirroring the detective's posture this whole interview. And that's not good because the detective's posture is somewhat closed. He keeps his legs crossed and a memo pad on his lap the entire interview.
Well, here's something else I want to take a look at. Let's start the video at 54 minutes and 8 seconds. What's happened up to this point is Brooks explaining to the detective how he doesn't appreciate everyone dragging his name through the mud and that his only concern is for his 2-year-old son.
You know, they need to re-examine all these other actions, how, you know, and I can understand the family wanting to vent and stress, and it makes perfect sense to me, but these people know me better than what's going on, and before this is all over and done with, you all are too, but it really, it bothers me because not only have I been a victim, I can't even... My mind's not even where it should be because I'm trying to protect Eli from this, and I'm trying to, he's the most important person that I'm trying to protect. I don't care about them dragging my name through the mud right now because I'm going to keep the main focus and emphasis on bringing her back safely and as quickly as possible, but it really bothers me what's being done in the method that everybody's pursuing and doing, because what's going to happen is I don't want their apologies. I don't want nothing from them. But then after this is all said and done, they're going to sweep it under the rug, and then they're just going to forget about what they've done to me in the process. Mm-hmm. What I've got to be faced with now is, as good a mother as Crystal's been, now nobody's going to love you like a mother. Now Eli is in an atmosphere where I've got all the hope in the world, but now I'm a single parent, it appears to me, where she's been there 100% of the time for him to raise and rear him, where I know that he didn't have to go to a daycare or a babysitter, and I know that his mother is going to take care of him. And now where am I at without that love and support from her? Mm-hmm. Now I've got a little boy who's 2, who's going to grow up his life. If something's not done where she's not brought back safely, now one of the very most important people in his life, he's got to grow up without. Right.
Okay, so even though Brooks is careful to provide the disclaimer he has all the hope in the world, he is speaking in terms of he and his son being without Crystal for the rest of their lives. And this is just 3 days after she was reported missing. So in my opinion, and in my experience, if a loving partner actually has hope their partner will return home safe, they tend to avoid speaking in terms of their partner never returning home because it hurts like hell to do so. And they don't want to believe that will be the final outcome. And of course, something else for your notebook, Brooks is portraying himself as the victim, which we never like to see.
Mm-mm.
Now, I'd also like to point out that at this point, we're not seeing or hearing any emotion from Brooks. No tears, he doesn't get choked up, and we never speak in absolutes because every person handles grief differently, and he's had a few days to possibly get a lot of that out of his system. But we're about to play you a moment in this interview where we do see some tears, and he does get choked up. So let's start the video at 56 minutes, 44 seconds.
I've been extremely honest with you all, and now I'm up here doing, they can have the house, y'all take anything that you want, you don't need any of that paperwork or search warrants, and now I'm up here trying to get my head where I can be on the side of being able to protect myself and defend myself for my son whenever I'm the one that's, I feel like, has the largest loss.
Yeah.
So do what you gotta do. I'll do whatever I can, but this is starting to get silly. I don't need an attorney. I haven't asked for an attorney. I don't need none of that. I'm innocent. I'm willing to talk to whoever. But this to me is really starting to get silly because I feel like I don't have a Facebook page. I don't have time to get on the internet. I don't know a lot about computers. Crystal did all that for me. I didn't have to do it because that's something else that she always took care of. So now I have people coming back to me telling me that they're completely trashing me online for the home media. You know, I've taken 17 years of my life, and I feel like I've gotten worked hard to get a good education. I worked hard all these years. I've built a nice life for me and my family, and now my whole family's name is trashed for something that's completely not even tied to me. That's where I'm at right now. So I'm extremely upset. I'm hurt over it. I try to put on a tough shell and a bubble and move forward. It's extremely difficult to get up in the morning and push on and look at Eli and know that here I've got a million things going on that I have to get done. And then who's going to suffer? He is. And it's not right. I'm ready to hire an auctioneer to sell all this stuff so I can be there for him, like Chris. What else do you want to know?
Take a minute, it's all right.
No, it's...
It's fine to be upset, I understand. It's fine to be mad. I understand that too.
He's there asking for everybody. This is a shock to him.
It's okay to be upset by it, I understand. It's okay to be upset at her family.
Their emotions are so shot right now. I can understand it, and I don't. If that's how they want to be,
but you're allowed to be emotional too.
That's fine.
Okay, so we're hearing some emotion here. That's something you've been waiting for, right?
Well, I want to be careful here, not to be unfair, but I can't help but notice how we are nearly 1 hour into this interview. And the first topic that brings Brooks to tears is the community's reaction and opinion of him. The accusations that he is responsible for her disappearance, not her disappearance in and of itself. Now, he gets especially upset when he mentions how his son has to grow up hearing this stuff. So we do see his emotional attachment to his son. And it could be that the thought of his son tore down a masculine wall he's put up to keep from falling apart about Crystal's disappearance. So I'll pose that as a possibility in the spirit of fairness. But it's also possible that the thought of his son has unleashed a sudden and tremendous amount of guilt that he hasn't considered until this very moment, like the realization of what he has taken from his son. And it's also possible he's experiencing real fear for the first time. Fear that he will be held responsible for Crystal's disappearance and even her death. And if that happens, he will never see his son again without a very thick glass window between them. Any of these things are possible explanations for what we're seeing and hearing in this section of the interview. But because it's the first time we see him react emotionally and we're 1 hour in, it's important for the detective to explore why. And he really doesn't.
So if you're the detective interviewing Brooks and emotionally finally hits an hour in, what are you going to follow up with in this moment?
I'd start asking open-ended questions. Questions like, what are you thinking about right now, Brooks? Or what scares you the most about what's going on, Brooks? A question that causes him to search inside himself for a response. Instead, this detective throws justifiable reasons for Brooks's emotional reaction at him that can act like little life preservers for someone in Brooks's position. Don't do that. He's showing weakness and vulnerability for the very first time. Exploit that. Don't help him get firm footing all over again.
Could it be that Detective Snow is just trying to play a consoling good cop here? You know, get a connection established with Brooks. Hey, I'm your friend. I understand.
Sure. I mean, establishing rapport is always a good thing, no doubt. But there's a time and place for it. And this is not the time or place. If I'm seeing this happen, I'm thinking Brooks has tapped into something he hasn't dealt with up to this point. He's left the dress rehearsal. He's reacting to something significant, and I need to get some idea of what that is. Now, he might not give me the complete truth in his answer, but let's say he says something like, I'm scared I'll go to prison and never see my son again. Now I have something to work with. Maybe now I need to start educating him about how cooperation can determine how long that prison stay might be, or even how it could be the difference between a death sentence or a life sentence. Those are things that can get confessions out of even the toughest of suspects.
Okay, so play into his tapped emotion and figure out if there's something there that can be used as leverage to get to the truth. I like it. Moving into this next clip, Detective Snow does tap into a possible lack of concern, pointing out that Brooks doesn't seem worried the day after Crystal was last seen.
So then you, sometime Saturday evening, you went over to Fabian's house. Do you remember around about what time that was? That would have been 4th of July.
Yeah, so that's when we were supposed to go to that.
Mm-hmm. Did you all stay out there for fireworks? Or
we didn't stay that late. I know that there was a bunch of people there that I hadn't seen in a good while. And my mom's got a pretty large family that I hadn't seen, and I wanted to see them. But we didn't stay out there real late.
Do you any idea how many times you've called Crystal at this point? By the time you went from getting up Saturday morning until you were going to the family
gathering. I called her back around maybe noon again the second time. And I don't know what the exact time I called her after that. But I know that sometimes in the past, if I call her and blow her phone up, it made it worse. Mm-hmm. So sometimes I've just called periodically, and I found that she doesn't take as much offense to that. You know, if you're just disrespectful to them, especially if somebody's mad, it just makes it worse. To
right.
call them. I wasn't even alarmed. I was for sure the girls were doing this to me on purpose. Brooke and Sabrina and them.
Okay, I keep saying this over and over again, but I have to. We have to be fair here because we don't know the dynamic of their relationship and how Brooks and Crystal handle disagreements or spats, if that's indeed what he honestly believed was going on. But obviously, for the vast majority of us, if our spouse or partner isn't home when we wake up, and when we call them the next morning, they don't answer, then we don't think to call them again until noon? That's suspicious. That's why the detective is pointing it out. And Brooks has an explanation for that is in the realm of plausibility, that being she has done this before, so he wasn't alarmed. But no reasonable person, or definitely no reasonable police officer, is going to believe that. Right or wrong, fair or unfair, we ain't buying it.
Let's back up for a minute. Let me remind you of something here, Todd. When her mom ran into Brooks the day after he is referring to in this interview with Detective Snow, on Sunday, July 5th, she asks him point blank, did you get into a fight? His response, according to her, was, well, we got into a little argument. But this alleged argument does not come up in this interview with Detective Snow. So, did he not call her again until noon because they were in a fight? Or did he not call her because he knew she couldn't answer the phone?
It's interesting, right? We're seeing a discrepancy in the timeline of events preceding Crystal's disappearance. In the story he gave Crystal's mom, it would be far more believable that Crystal would have left without telling him to go blow off some steam with her sister and cousin or whatever. But in the story he gave Detective Snow, he described them as having a perfect family day and night that ended with him going to bed and Crystal staying up to play on her phone. And then when he woke up in the morning, she was gone. Now, we don't know which of those two stories is closest to the truth, but that doesn't matter right now. What does matter is he's providing two different accounts. And if he's simply recalling what happened and not creating something that didn't happen, why are there two different accounts?
That's a good point. And I got to tell you, I know Sherry would not have been shy when she reported her daughter missing that same day that she ran into Brooks and leave out the part about the argument they had. So why are we not hearing Detective Snow getting to the bottom of these two stories?
That's another great question. Let's give him the benefit of the doubt and say maybe he doesn't know what was said between Sherry and Brooks that day.
Okay. Well, let's move on and take a look at what starts off with Brooks explaining to the detective how he and Crystal hardly ever get a babysitter to watch the kids because they rarely go out by themselves without at least their son or even all the kids. Then things take a turn as the detective reveals why this fact is relevant to his investigation.
So if you had to guess, how often would you say she would go out?
She doesn't go out real often. Not real often. I mean, she's got all her kids, and we got Eli. I mean, we have a pretty busy lifestyle, and seems like we've always got kids here and there. So I mean,
right.
We don't have a whole lot of time to do that. We don't like to get babysitters all the time. You know, sometimes if our parents have a couple of the kids, or Keith might have a couple of them, we might go out with. Always, usually, you know, with Eli, we don't usually seldom ever get a babysitter for him.
Mm-hmm.
And we take him with us, but other than that,
I guess the reason I'm confused about that is because you said it was not unusual for her to go out with the girls.
It's not unusual. Yeah,
so help me understand. You mean,
but that's what
once a month, or once every other month, or. I mean, how much time are we talking about here? You know, because my wife might have a girl night a couple times a year, but she might not be the typical wife either. Yeah, I don't know.
Maybe about two times every 3 months.
Okay.
Like once every 6 weeks or something like that.
Sure. Okay. You said that Eli generally does not go to a babysitter.
No, he doesn't. I don't want him at a baby, and I certainly don't want him at somebody's house that smokes. I'd rather just keep him right with me, and I'd rather, if we're going out doing something, I'd rather just take him right along,
mm-hmm.
you know, right along with
him. Well, so that kind of brings me to one of my questions that I had. We talked a little bit about the last time that we talked when we were at your house, and you kind of explained it, you know, and I get the fact that she would tell the kids, you know, hey, we got a babysitter for the night or for the evening, we're going to go out, mm-hmm. you know. I get that. You explain that the other kids kind of get jealous. If you guys
we don't want to hurt their feelings.
Sure, sure.
Especially Kylie, the situation. She's always wanted a father. I mean, any kid who wants a father figure in her life. She's really struggled in that area, and her mother doesn't want her to think that she's pushing one of the children out, and then the other one can go with us. I mean, that's normal. I mean, in my opinion,
sure.
It is.
And I get why she might tell Keith that, because Keith has two of the kids. Mm-hmm. She doesn't want him to tell them differently than what she's told them. Are you familiar with a woman named Christina Holly?
Yes, I know who you're talking about.
Okay. There are some text messages between her and Crystal on Friday. And she's asking Crystal if she wants to go to Chuck E. Cheese, I think it was. Something to do with the kids. And she tells her the same thing. Well, we've got a sitter for the evening. It's our first time being kid free for a while, so we don't want to, you know, we're kid free. We're going to enjoy ourselves.
Right.
Why would she lie to her about that?
I don't know. I can't answer that question.
We might have just seen and heard Brooks get hit with his second big surprise in this interview, because he looks and sounds like he's on his heels again. The first big surprise was the mention of Danny Singleton, and now the fact that Crystal had told one of her best friends that their plans were to go out alone the night she disappeared and not to go to the farm, which is Brooks' story, and what Brooks knows the phone records will likely show. And he doesn't have an obvious physical reaction to the surprise like he did with the Danny Singleton surprise. But I can tell you for certain, he was not expecting this. And if he is indeed lying about their plans for that night, he did not have a good answer for that question. So he smartly chose to say he can't answer that question, which out of fairness is the answer a truthful person might give. But here, based on what I'm seeing and what I'm hearing, my gut says Brooks was caught off guard with information he was not aware of, and therefore was not prepared to defend himself against it. So he wisely chose the response after, admittedly, some contemplation, I can't answer that question.
Okay, I'm writing that down. But also remember that name I told you to write down earlier, Joseph Lawson? Here's why. While Brooks is talking to the detective, another name comes up. Around midnight, Brooks had received a 13-second call to his cell phone. But Brooks tells the detective he doesn't remember who called him. So Detective Snow asks him, who's Steve Lawson? Turns out he works for Brooks. So from inside that interrogation room, Brooks calls Steve to find out why he had called him. And remember, this was just a few nights earlier.
Okay, we put that number in.
Yeah, go right ahead. Do what you gotta do.
Looks like you got a couple messages.
Yeah, I don't know how to do it. I've got an Apple phone. So
just want to put the number in, right?
Or check contacts or however you do it to see who it is. Yeah.
192-1390. Just call it. Oh, Steve Lawson.
Okay. Who is Steve Lawson?
He's somebody that works for me. Hey Steve.
Yeah.
Hey, I can't hear you real good. I'm gonna ask you to speak up a little bit, okay?
Okay, sir.
Hey, I was wanting to know, I've got some things going on next week. I'm gonna need your help with me. Are you already booked up or can you help me?
I haven't moved up yet. I'm still looking for a place. That's why I needed two numbers from you.
All right. Well, I can write them all down and get them there for you. But I was actually talking about doing some more work with your little skid steer and so forth. Mine's still broke down. It is a very difficult and trying time, but I appreciate you saying that. But hey, I need your help while I got you on the phone here. Do you remember the other night you called me really, really late, and I forgot what you asked me. Can you, I guess it wasn't on the phone. I might have been tired. I know it was pretty late at night. Can you remember what you asked me or what you were after? I can't remember.
Yes, sir, I can. I called to ask you for them numbers for our house.
Oh, for a rental house.
Yes, sir.
And what did I forgot? What did I tell you?
You told me that you would call. What's her name? Katie or whatever she handles all that.
Crystal.
Okay, I apologize.
Yeah.
And you said she handles all that, and that you would get back with me on it.
All right. Thank you so much, Neil.
Hey, if there's anything I can do.
Thank you. You have a good night now.
Yes, sir. God bless you.
Thank you.
Okay. So that begs a question in my mind.
All right.
If she's in the truck next to you when he called, why would you need to call her about getting numbers for rental
property? Because being that late at night, we're headed to the house, you know, I just wouldn't... She normally's not going to deal with stuff that late. I mean, I probably didn't even look at the phone to see who it was calling me. I'm sure I just answered it, you know.
But he said you told him that you'd need to call her.
All right.
Why would you need to call her? I mean, that's an odd phrase for someone who's sitting next to you in the truck. Do you understand? You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I see exactly what you're saying. But I mean, if that right there is what I told him, we wasn't on the phone that long. But normally I would just, she handles all that, and that's what I would do. She's not going to want to mess with that kind of stuff that late. I'm sure I'll probably try to answer the phone really quickly so that it wouldn't, a lot of times after I get moving, Eli goes to sleep, you know. Sometimes he goes to sleep in the truck, sometimes he doesn't. So if you want to call him, you got his number and everything. If you want to call him, you know, you can call him.
Now first, what's interesting is Brooks is contradicting himself, and Detective Snow takes notice. Brooks allegedly tells Steve Lawson that he's going to have to call Crystal about it. Why would Brooks need to call Crystal if she's sitting right next to him in the truck when Steve calls him? They're supposed to be driving home together after feeding the cows on his family's farm. Why not hand the phone to her? Or just say, I'll have to call you back after I talk to Crystal. Or better yet, I'll have Crystal call you back tomorrow, you know, because it's midnight. I have not been able to confirm definitively yet, but I have been told by a source that Steve Lawson is Joseph Lawson's father.
Here's something else I want to discuss. There's something that occurs during this phone conversation that immediately triggered me because of specific experience in my law enforcement career. I spent the majority of my career in covert drug investigations. I was undercover for a long time, and I specialized in wiretaps. I have listened to more people who participate in drug trafficking and other criminal conspiracies than I ever care to quantify. It's countless. And at one point, very early into this phone conversation between Brooks and Steve Lawson, for no good reason, Brooks says to Steve Lawson, or whoever it is on the other end of the phone, something to the effect, I'm having a hard time hearing you, so can you speak up for me? Now, I say for no good reason because we can hear him just fine. And we're listening to the video recording of him speaking through the phone speaker. So we know Brooks and the detective could hear him just fine. And I'm not saying what I'm about to say is true. I'm merely saying that I find it extremely odd that Brooks would say that to Steve Lawson when we can hear for ourselves. Everyone in that room could hear him just fine. And because of that, it immediately brought to mind something I've experienced a great deal in covert drug investigations, and that is members of a network or organization speaking in code. A code that has been predefined for everyone within that organization or group. So here's my hypothetical. If this was a drug case, and this detective was my partner, and he was using Brooks at that moment as a confidential informant and trying to get him to dirty Steve Lawson over this phone call, after that call ended, I would tell my partner, don't trust that informant, because I think I'm having a hard time hearing you, so can you speak up? It's code for the cops are listening to us right now, so don't say anything stupid. The other reason I think this is possible is after Steve is told this and talks more for a bit, he, for no good reason, says to Brooks, I know you're having a hard time hearing me. That's because of where I'm at. And I say for no good reason because Brooks never interrupts him and says, hey, brother, I'm still having a hard time hearing you or anything to that effect. Steve just keeps on talking. Then after a bit, he just stops to say that at a time that makes it way out of place and unnecessary. So with organizations or groups that do use code like this, Steve's line, I know you're having a hard time hearing me, that's because of where I'm at, would be the acknowledgement. Code for, hey, I caught what you said earlier, brother, so don't worry. I'm clear the cops are listening. I'm not going to say anything stupid. That's how code like this works. And again, I'm not saying that's what these two were doing. I just find it very strange and out of place. So it reminds me of countless calls I've heard in drug investigations where one of our cooperators intentionally compromised the fact that he was cooperating through the use of code.
I love your mind, Todd.
It's got all kinds of information stuck in here.
Wow. Okay, but this isn't the only phone call inside that room at the sheriff's office. In fact, just a few minutes after this call with Steve Lawson, Brooks' cell phone starts ringing. It's his brother. More to the point, it's Bardstown police officer Nick Houck. Let's listen in, shall we?
Well, okay. So I guess where I go from here, we're still getting video from different places, you know, that along that route.
Can I get this?
Sure, please. Yes.
Hello?
No.
I'm up here. I know that you didn't know. I'm up here in this interview with the detective, Detective Snow. I've been up here a good little while. I'm filling out this this statement here and everything. Are you telling me that's what I need to do?
Uh,
I know I'm not. I know that. But the way that I look at it is I'm innocent. I ain't done nothing wrong. Well, you know, I know you've told me innocent people have got jammed up, but if you're telling me to leave, I'll get up and leave. If you want me to... I know I'm going through a lot, but I'm trying to get this guy to help me. I don't think she's ran off with some other guy. I don't believe that. You can't make me think that. No. Yeah, so do I. I'll do exactly what you're telling me to do right now. Do you want me to get up and leave? Man, I don't think these people have got vindictive just to skin me for no reason. Man, this is not their family. This is not. All right, thank you. He thinks y'all are gonna fuck is what he thinks.
I don't know who he is.
Nick, my brother.
Did you want to go here for
no, me? I know it, but I'm not. He just said just to keep sitting up here, he said, give a statement, do an interview, whatever I got to do it. But he said, darn, just to keep just letting them just beat you to death over this right here, just ask what you got to ask and let you know.
This interrupting and interfering phone call ends up costing Nick his job on the force, but more on that later. What do you think about this, Todd?
I think there's too many damn phone calls going on during this interview. It's right? Chaos. Why is this happening? And here's another question I have. How did Nick know at that very moment Brooks was in that interview at the sheriff's office? Brooks has been in that chair for nearly 2 hours just for the oral interview. That's not counting how long he was there for his written statement beforehand. But he's just now calling him? And it didn't sound random to me. It sounded like he knew exactly where Brooks was and what he was doing. So did Nick just happen to drive by the sheriff's office because he couldn't reach him when officers were data dumping Brooks's phone and saw Brooks's vehicle there? Maybe. Did Brooks tell him beforehand he was going there to drop off his phone at a certain time and Nick started to panic because he'd been there longer than he expected? Maybe. I just think the timing of his phone call is interesting. Interesting because it happens less than 7 minutes after Brooks hangs up with Steve Lawson. So let's play pretend for a second. Let's just pretend for demonstrative purposes that my hypothetical scenario about Brooks and Steve Lawson using code happens to be true. If that were the case, then might Steve Lawson be duty bound to alert all the other co-conspirators that Brooks is with the police and that they're listening to calls he's placing in their presence? Of course that would make sense. If for no other reason than for them to all know they need to be careful. And if that were the case, might that mean Nick is a co-conspirator? I'd love to see Nick's phone records for this day and this time window. That's all I'm saying. Again, I can't say this enough. We're not stating any of this as fact. We're just presenting plausible and reasonable explanations and scenarios based on our own training and experience. So please accept everything we've said in this recording for its intended purpose, which is simply fodder for thought.
I think that's perfectly acceptable because, Todd, you're a pretty smart cookie. There, I said it on the record, recorded. Write that down in your notebook.
Well, I'm an old cookie, which means I'm a little stale, but it also means I have absorbed a certain amount of knowledge over the years. Now, let me close this out. I know I've been very wordy and very talkative here, but let me close this out with a little more, just a little more critiquing of the detective. And keep in mind, it's way easier to be the Monday morning detective than the game time detective. But regardless, I do want to point this out. This detective spends the last 5 minutes that he has with Brooks detailing every movement to Brooks about where he's headed in this investigation. Essentially, he gives a roadmap for someone, if they're guilty, to cover their tracks or prepare a defense. So basically, at the end of this interview, Brooks is handed a photocopy of his own handwritten statement, and he's given a detailed verbal rundown of everything the detective plans to do next. So for any future police detectives that might be listening to this episode, don't do that.
But why, Todd?
Right? Because we don't work for the defense. If we did, we'd all drive nicer cars.
Well, not too long after this interview with Nelson County Sheriff's Detective John Snow, and after Brooks leaves with his defense script in hand, Sheriff Ed Mattingly, who, by the way, beat out Brooks in the 2014 sheriff's race, makes a pretty huge announcement.
Hold the dough. You can't drop an atom bomb of a fact on us like Brooks ran for Nelson County Sheriff the year before Crystal went missing and then gloss right past it. You didn't say something trivial like he was right-handed. You said he ran for sheriff.
All in good time, partner. This is just part one. In October 2015, 3 months after Crystal Rogers went missing, the sheriff publicly names Brooks Houck as the prime suspect in her disappearance. He also tells local media that she's likely deceased because she hasn't reached out to her tight-knit family. At that press conference, the sheriff makes note of 8 pages of circumstances pointing to Brooks. He goes on to say that he thinks his brother Nick knows what happened to Crystal. At this point in the investigation, Brooks had never been arrested or charged in connection to her case. But the sheriff did state that as soon as they had enough evidence against Brooks, he would be arrested.
I do not mind a sheriff going hard publicly on a suspect. It's old school, and you have to be careful and mindful how you phrase it when you do so, but it definitely shows confidence in their investigation and the direction that it's focused.
And since you listened to his interview, do you think the sheriff has a right to be so confident this early on?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I've agreed with your opinion of who's responsible for Crystal's disappearance since the very first time you presented this case to me. And that was way, way, way before this case broke wide open. The truth runs through Brooks Houck.
Well, 8 years after Crystal's disappearance, it appears that the truth might finally be unveiled. That sheriff's words from 2015, that when there was enough evidence to arrest him, it would happen, has happened. On September 27th, 2023, 41-year-old Brooks Houck was arrested and charged with murder and tampering with physical evidence. He was held on a $10 million cash bond and ordered not to have contact with Crystal's family. Here's the FBI's statement on his arrest. In coordination with the Kentucky State Police, other local and federal law enforcement partners, FBI Louisville has been laser-focused on our commitment to hold accountable those that were responsible for the disappearance of Crystal Rogers. Today, we take the first step in making good on that promise. FBI Louisville and the Kentucky State Police have arrested Brooks Houck without incident on charges stemming from the Crystal Rogers investigation.
It's clear by the information released about Brooks's arrest that the government's evidence puts Brooks Houck in the middle of this conspiracy to murder Crystal Rogers. He has been charged with murder, not conspiracy to commit murder, so that immediately assigns him a more accountable role than Joseph Lawson, who is charged with conspiracy. And we're fairly certain Brooks won't be the last person indicted, so it's going to be interesting not only to see who's next, but what complicity they're assigned.
I believe what we are seeing in this investigation and serving justice on those responsible for her murder has just begun. On the Bluegrass Parkway at mile marker 14, there's an oversized poster with Crystal's photo. And below her smile is a photo of her car that was found in that very spot, asking for passersby to call with information if they saw her car on the parkway. When I spoke to Sherry back in 2019 about Crystal's case, she said while she credits police with the work they've done all those years, she didn't think they had done enough in the first 2 weeks of Crystal's case. She believed that it was their assumption her daughter just up and left on her own, and her disappearance wasn't taken seriously. She knows Crystal would never leave without a word and without a trace. She wouldn't leave her and her dad, and especially not her five children. And she said she'll never stop speaking up and speaking out for her daughter, telling me, quote, "I will be her voice until I can't be no more." But thankfully, for Crystal's family and the entire Bardstown community, justice is on its way.
Hopefully, even though it's overdue, she and her family find some solace in these recent developments. Coming up next week, Brooks wasn't the only Hauk in the hot seat. His brother Nick has definitely been on the radar, and as you'll learn in part two, that dude is a different kind of animal.
And Sherry Ballard would mourn another crushing loss to her family. The FBI has created a task force for Crystal's case, and Team Crystal has a Facebook page. You can find links to those in the show notes on our website, investigatorspodcast.com.
That's also where you can submit cases you'd like us to dig into. Just hit the case submission button at the bottom of the homepage.
If you like this show, please tell your friends and take a minute to rate and write a review. Until next week, take care and take care of each other.
And most importantly, remember, if you're a detective and you're holding the main suspect's phone during his interview, don't turn his damn phone on in the middle of it and hand it to him so he can start placing and receiving calls that might fuck up the entire interview. Because if you do, you might have to deal with us calling you out for it. Because we're the investigators!
I came from the mud. There's dirt on my hands. Strong like a tree. There's roots where I stand. Oh, I've been running from the law. Hope they won't shoot me down soon. Catch me howling at the moon.